Okay, this is, I have no idea what today
21st.
Is. The 19th? 21st. 21st. Okay.
21st.
Okay, good. The 21st of...
23rd?
No, 21st.
Yeah.
Of November. And so let me kind of quickly go over what we were talking about last time. We began, finally, James's pragmatism, which I guess you could say is the official statement of James's version of pragmatism that Peirce later, remember, for himself, renamed pragmaticism. And I can see why. I was telling Patty on the way in, it is so maddening. James can be just so maddening, honestly. But, you know, I think to myself, okay, he was a child of the Romantic Age, I guess, in which precision of thought was not really the going thing. I swear, you know, he'll say something, and you'll say to him, I mean, I'm imagining, this is Laura, by the way, Laura Jeppe is here, Patty? Laura. Oh, you got her? Okay. He'll say something, you know, something wrong, and you say, so you're saying this, and he'll say, that's not what I mean. I mean this. And so then you'll restate it, and you say, oh, I'm sorry, then you're saying this. And he'll say, no, that's not what I mean. I mean this. And, you know, you're just constantly shifting around, and it's so difficult to pin him down. And, but, you know, I don't know, maybe it's partly because these are lectures. I just don't know.
The Romantics wrote the best poetry, huh?
Yeah, they did. I don't have a problem with Romantic poetry, or Romantic music, for that matter. I like it. But Romantic philosophy is something that, it's almost an oxymoron. Well, anyway, but let me just kind of recap what we talked about last time. I opened up to practically the first page of the first lecture. This is a series of, 8 lectures, I think it was. And the very first one, well, actually, what's the title of the Present Dilemma in Philosophy was the title of the first lecture. And what I have on the board over here is the sum and substance of what we went over last time. And actually, well, here I was criticizing William James. In my book, I used that very distinction. I used it to organize everything in the book, so I shouldn't be too hard on the guy. He is a fairly well-known distinction of what he says are two philosophical temperaments. And this is not a hard and fast kind of thing, but, you know, it really does hit on tendencies you find out there in the tradition. So he has the tender-minded and the tough-minded thinkers. And you're just kind of born somehow genetically more predisposed toward one or toward the other. And then in that opening passage that I talked about last week, he goes down and lists several typical, and this is, once again, not absolutely hard and fast, and who, oh, Bonnie just joined. So Bonnie. So this is not... you can find exceptions, so once again, this is not kind of something that's, you know, set in stone, but they are tendencies, and I think he's broadly right. So he has, well, the tender-minded thinkers tend to be intellectualistic, and by the way, I should have written up there, and somebody asked me about it after class, I think, when we get to that chart, he says, going by principles, and an empiricist is going by facts. So maybe I should put principles in parentheses here and facts in parentheses over here. That's one contrast, going by just intellectual principles, abstract, in other words, principles, as opposed to the concrete facts. And, of course, intellectualistic, rationalistic, empiricist, intellectualistic and sensationalistic, almost the same thing. Idealistic versus materialistic. Of course, idealism is the idea that the spiritual world is fundamental. The material world is either not there at all or less fundamental. And materialism is the opposite. And then optimistic and pessimistic. We all know what that means. The tender-minded thinkers tend to be on the religious side, and the tough-minded thinkers tend to be the skeptics. For example, the hardcore logical positivists, whom I cite over and over again, who want to take this circle and shrink it down to the to the bare minimum. They would certainly be very much on the tough-minded side. And I honestly, it's true, just from my experience in graduate school, I mean, most Anglophone philosophers are biased toward the tough-minded side of things. In some cases, violently anti-religious. I mean, when I was at Iowa, there was one guy there that just practically every... I mean, I never took a course with him, but I don't know how I had... Maybe, was I TA under? I can't remember. Maybe just from time to time he would speak, but somehow it would always wind up, talking about religion. Well, anyway, tender-minded, free-willist, fatalistic. So if everything is determined, if there are no, if everything is a result of a prior cause, that would be a complete deterministic outlook. Monistic, he'll have a lot to say about that. Monistic versus pluralistic. And William James himself wants to think, and as we'll see, I don't know if we'll get to it today, but at some point, William James himself thinks of himself as being a religious pluralist as opposed to a religious monist. What would a religious monist look like? Well, I'm sure that he has in mind Hegel. I mean, Hegelianism is sometimes called absolute idealism, where the only entity is consciousness with a capital C, basically God. Probably a more intelligible, because Hegel's not terribly intelligible, but a more intelligible version of monism is what Jay and I were talking about before class, the Bhagavad Gita and some of the Upanishads that are in line with the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna learns, eventually, by the time you get around to chapter 11 of Bhagavad Gita, he learns that really there's just one thing there, one thing out there that's Brahman, and all these other plural things are a somehow less correct picture of reality than the one thing, Brahman. that's an ultra, James would classify it as an ultra tender-minded metaphysics, where there really is just one thing, and everything else is Maya, which is a sort of a distorted, that's how I like to think of Maya, a distorted picture of reality. But, of course, tough-minded thinkers are happy with multiple entities or multiple this and that. And finally, the tender-minded tend to think more dogmatically, and there's a fair amount of skepticism associated with... And all he means by that is the tender-minded thinkers tend to be more speculative. They're more comfortable with less evidence. They're more comfortable with less evidence, put it that way. So it will allow you to speculate more, whereas tough-minded thinkers want to tighten things down and not accept something unless it has a certain degree of scientific credibility. Thus, once again, positivism, which is an excellent example of a fairly extreme tough-minded worldview. So that's what we talked about last time, and we're right still in the middle of the first lecture. So then the question is, well, how does pragmatism fit in all this, into this framework? And I'll read a couple of further paragraphs in lecture one, and we'll see what he has to say about that. It is at this point that my own solution begins to appear. I offer the oddly named thing pragmatism as a philosophy that can satisfy both kinds of demand. So he wants to, I mean, he thinks at least that pragmatism is going to be something that's going to be able to appeal to both tender-minded and tough-minded thinkers. Now, I will, however, hasten to add that James's version of pragmatism is going to certainly lean in the tough-minded direction. Or at least that's what he says. Maybe we should wait till the end of our whole series on James to see if what he says is what he does. But at any rate, that's what he says, because he, as you'll see in a minute, or at some point, as you'll see, he contrasts his view a lot with Hegel, implicitly, with Hegel, or the Hegelian spirit, put it that way. I mean, Josiah Royce, for example, was an American thinker of an idealistic stripe, contemporary with William James. But ultimately, the whole thing was, Hegel just is part of the wash that that Hegel initiated throughout the Western world, really. So Hegel is really the sort of the starting point for all of this, and James is going to define his position in opposition to that. So therefore, he's actually going to wind up, at least he thinks, on the more tough-minded side. But you know, pragmatism, he wants to say, is going to appeal across the board to both types of thinkers. We'll see. We'll see about that. Anyway, so philosophy that can satisfy both kinds of demand. It can remain religious like the rationalisms, but at the same time, like the empiricisms, it can preserve the richest intimacy with facts. So that's what he wants to do. And, of course, the strategy is going to be, as I have said many times, is taking this circle and expanding it, while giving lip service to, well, there are bounds out there, and there are criteria for determining if something is believable or whatever. You know, there are bounds, but those bounds get really stretched. The circle would be like that, something like that. So it's going to include religion much more than your typical positivist or descendant of positivism, say. Okey-dokey. Then he says at the end of that first lecture, few people have definitely articulated philosophies of their own, but almost everyone has his own peculiar sense of a certain total character in the universe, and of the inadequacy fully, inadequacy fully to match it of the particular systems that he knows. They don't just cover his world. One will be too dapper, another too pedantic, a third too much of a job lot of opinions, a fourth too morbid, a fifth too artificial or whatnot. At any rate, he and we know offhand that such philosophies are out of plumb and out of key and out of whack and have no business to speak up in the universe's name. And then he names a bunch of philosophers. But anyway, we philosophers have to reckon with such feelings on your part, you, the audience. In the last resort, I repeat, it will be by them that all our philosophies shall ultimately be judged. The finally victorious way of looking at things will be the most completely impressive way to the normal run of minds. So, I guess he's saying, you know, here I'm going to give you seven more lectures here, and the proof is in the pudding, right? You guys are going to be the ones ultimately to judge whether what I'm saying is strikes a chord in you. So now, so we pick up, if we pick up with lecture two, and I'm actually going to pick up with lecture two and then go on to lecture six, because those are the two sort of theoretical parts of it. There's a lot of pragmatism that deals with what he calls the test cases, or what was his word? That's not the word he uses, but some metaphysical problem. So in other words, we're going to apply this, and we're going to see how it, you know, how it works in practice. But before we apply it, let's get out more about the theory. So pragmatism is, and I think he's correct, is both a theory of meaning and a theory of truth. In other words, if you want to understand this, remember in Peirce, remember the how to make our ideas clear. And Peirce said, if you really want to clarify what you're saying, then you have to ask what pragmatic effects some sort of idea would have. Well, that's a theory of meaning. I mean, he's talking about meaning there. You know, what do I mean by blah, whatever it is? And then I say, well, okay, if that's the case, then you should expect to find X, Y, and Z. Okay, whatever. That's a theory of meaning. A theory of truth would have to do with how do I verify or falsify or say that something is acceptable versus not acceptable. That would be a theory of truth. There's a difference between meaning and truth, of course. And pragmatism is both a theory of meaning and a theory of truth, right? So he starts off with the meaning side of it, and he tells a story. This is so quintessentially American. Not saying it's a bad thing.
You got a problem with it?
No. It's just so much. It's just, well, let me read it. It's about a page and a half or something like that. But remember, this will have to do with meaning. It'll have to do with clarifying what you're saying. Some years ago, being with a camping party in the mountains, I returned from a solitary ramble to find everyone engaged in a ferocious metaphysical dispute. The corpus of the dispute was a squirrel. A live squirrel supposed to be clinging to one side of a tree trunk, while over against the tree's opposite side, a human being was imagined to stand. This human witness tries to get sight of the squirrel by moving rapidly round the tree, but no matter how fast he goes, the squirrel moves as fast in the opposite direction and always keeps the tree between himself and the man, so that never a glimpse of him is caught. The resultant metaphysical problem now is this. Does the man go round the squirrel or not? He goes round the tree, sure enough, and the squirrel is on the tree, but does he go round the squirrel? In the unlimited leisure of the wilderness, discussion had been worn threadbare. Everyone had taken sides and was obstinate. And the numbers on both sides were even. Each side, when I appeared, therefore, appealed to me to make it a majority. Mindful of the scholastic adage that whenever you meet a contradiction, you must make a distinction, I immediately sought and found one as follows. Which party is right, I said, depends on what you practically mean by going round the squirrel. If you mean passing to the north of him and then to the east, then to the south, and then to the west, and then to the north of him again, obviously the man does go round him, for he occupies these successive positions. But if on the contrary you mean being first in front of him, then on the right of him, then behind him, and then on the left, and finally on the front again, it is quite as obvious that the man fails to go round him, for by the compensating movements the squirrel makes, he keeps his belly turned towards the man all the time, and his back turned away. Make the distinction, and there is no occasion for any further dispute. You are both right and both wrong according as you conceive the verb to go round in one practical fashion or the other. See what I mean by this big quintessentially American story, right?
Sounds like Mark Twain.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Although one or two of the better disputants called my speech a shuffling evasion, saying they wanted no quibbling or scholastic hair splitting, but meant just plain, honest English round, the majority seemed to think that the distinction had assuaged the dispute. I tell this
time
trivial...
Time for cocktails, they decided.
Was that?
Time for cocktails.
Yeah, right. I tell this trivial anecdote because it is a peculiarly simple example of what I wish now to speak of as the pragmatic method. The pragmatic method is primarily a method of settling metaphysical disputes that otherwise might be interminable. Is the world one or many? Fated or free? Material or spiritual? Here are notions, well, I guess they're notorious too, but here are notions either of which may or may not hold good of the world. The disputes over such notions are unending. The pragmatic method in such cases is to try to interpret each notion by tracing its respective practical consequences. What difference would it practically make to anyone if this notion rather than that notion were true? If no practical difference whatever can be traced, then the alternatives mean practically the same thing. And all dispute is idle. Whenever a dispute is serious, we ought to be able to show some practical difference that must follow from one side or the other's being right. See? So, then this question of meaning, then, insofar as the pragmatic method is a method for clarifying meaning, you simply have to say, well, okay, what sorts of practical things would follow if such and such were true? and that's what it means. And if you have two competing theories, like the case of the squirrel, and you say, well, what would practically follow from this? Well, really the same thing. They would both agree that you go to the north, the east, the south, and the west, or whatever, and you don't go around the side and the back and the other side and the front of the squirrel. Right? They would both agree with all those facts. So the dispute was merely a verbal one, and it was totally idle. And, of course, we discover that by simply discovering what they mean by those ways of stating the facts of the case. So in that respect, then, you're asking for, or you're using this idea of the practical effects as a way of clarifying the meaning of a word or an expression, very much as Charles Sanders Peirce had talked about when he wrote that essay, How to Make Your Ideas Clear. That's what James is saying. We're making our ideas clear, right? The logical positivists of the 1930s would do the same thing, only they would have it much more restricted. You know, they would say that the meaning of a statement is its method of verification. What practical steps would I take to verify or falsify a given proposition? And that's its total meaning. And that was the main way they excluded metaphysics, because metaphysical propositions would have no practical effects. They're so abstract that there's no experiment I could design. And by the way, well, I'm getting a little bit off the subject, but certain scientific hypotheses have been criticized along the same lines. For example, string theory, which I think requires like 21 dimensions. I don't remember what it was, but at any rate, some people have said, well, this is such a speculative, mm-hmm. highly speculative theory. You haven't figured out yet how I could even, what kind of observations I could undertake to show either that it's true or false. So what are you even talking about? It doesn't really have any real meaning. And, you know, there's something to that. Well, anyway, that's the spirit behind it. And certainly, you know, just articulate what practical effect something has, and that will reveal what it really means. Okay? But pragmatism is not just a theory of meaning. It's also a theory of truth, according to William James. And Lecture 6 is titled Pragmatism's Conception of Truth. Here's where things get really weird and iffy and dicey and all that. If you look at the theory, it sounds a lot more definite than it is when he actually uses the theory. here's what he says. Pragmatism, on the other hand, asks its usual question, grant an idea or belief to be true, it says, what concrete difference will its being true make in anyone's actual life? How will the truth be realized? What experiences will be different from those which would obtain if the belief were false? What, in short, is the truth's cash value in experiential terms? The moment pragmatism asks this question, it sees the answer. True ideas are those that we can assimilate, validate, corroborate, and verify. False ideas are those that we cannot. That is the practical difference it makes to us to have true ideas. That, therefore, is the meaning of truth, for it is all that truth is known as. So, something is true if it has some sort of pragmatic utility, I guess I would say. I stated it a little more broadly than it appears in the text I just read you, because that's really where he winds up going. Does it have some sort of pragmatic utility? In How to Make Our Ideas Clear, Peirce had used as an example, now this is back to meaning again, but it kind of relates to this, had used as an example of something that was a meaningless dispute, the difference between transubstantiation and other ways of looking at the Eucharist. Remember that? And he says, well, you know, they're all going to say, when I look, I see a wafer, and it tastes an awful lot like bread. And when I drink the wine or the grape juice or something, whatever, it smells and tastes an awful lot like grape juice. So what practical difference is there between saying it's just bread and grape juice or just bread and wine and saying it's the body and blood of Christ? There's no practical difference because everybody would agree that all the sensations are the same. And I read that from that person's essay, and everybody was kind of nodding, and I get that, you know, so forth. But it didn't say at the time, but sometimes I think to myself, well, heck, I mean, maybe a Catholic, though, maybe couldn't say, I'm surprised somebody didn't say this, actually. Wouldn't maybe a Catholic say, well, yeah, but, you know, if you really think it's the body and blood of Christ, that elicits a far more greater sense of intimacy with my Savior than if I just think of it as a symbol with bread and wine, right? The way we think of it in the Methodist Church, it's just bread and wine or bread and grape juice. We don't even drink wine, but it's just bread and grape juice. And, you know, it's a reenactment of the Last Supper, you know, and maybe it makes that, maybe, more vivid to us. But I can see a Catholic coming back and saying, yeah, but what's the connection between this and your eternal salvation, which should be your real concern? But if somehow I am eating the body of and drinking the blood of God, what could be more intimate than that? And that's this overwhelming feeling of oneness. I mean, actually becomes part of me with Christ, and isn't that the whole point of the incarnation and all that sort of thing? It's God reaching out to humankind to bring us out of the degraded state in which we have descended due to our own free will, right? So I can see a Catholic saying that and saying, well, wait a minute now, what do you mean there's no difference between my theory of transubstantiation and, you know, Don Ross's idea that it's just bread and wine? You know, there is a practical difference, namely the religious feeling that results and possibly the actions that I take in the world. You know?
Except that's unprovable.
Why not? What do you mean unprovable? Why is it not
provable?
Well,
you're talking about the practical effects, right?
Yeah.
You just had this articulate thing about how it may matter to people. Mm-hmm. But we're supposed to be talking about truth. You're talking about meaning.
I know. I backed up to the purse thing.
What you just said, it may be truth how the people feel, but the transubstantiation is unprovable.
Yeah, but yes, okay, but you mean, but what do you mean by unprovable? Okay, unprovable by the pragmatic method of truth, you say.
Yes.
And what I'm saying
is unprovable as true.
Yeah, I get it. But what's provable? That's the question. And then if you say, well, provable along with the logical positivist, you say, I was going to present a narrower version first. The real tough-minded thinker would say, well, the provable is what I can see with my eyes and measure and that sort of thing. And I don't know what you're feeling, you know, but I can look and you look like a normal person to me, and everything you do is what a normal person would do. I don't see any practical effects. But if provable means something a little broader, like any sort of practical effect, like, you know, like Les would just, well, you didn't say it, but you you did that. You know, well, then that would pass the test, right? If you stretch the idea of provable in the kind of direction that James is going, right? I mean, you know, you can take a narrower definition of it, but the whole point of James's version of pragmatism is to take this circle and go like that with it, right? So, yeah, that would, why wouldn't that count as a practical effect? Is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, on the meaning side.
Yeah, well, but, oh, okay, but, yeah, there's a very thin line dividing the meaning and the truth.
Could you articulate the difference again?
between meaning and truth? Well, okay, well, first of all, the meaning would simply be whatever practical effects it would have, right? And then the truth would be, do those practical effects really happen? See what I mean? I mean, it's just like if I, well, my, the example that I used, well, I've used it like two or three times now, the Copernican theory and the Ptolemaic theory, and the Copernican theory would predict that Venus has phases depending on its orientation vis-a-vis the Earth around the Sun. And, well, okay, that is the meaning of, or part of the meaning anyway, of the Copernican hypothesis, that Venus will show phases. Well, that's its meaning. Well, now, is it true or not? Okay, well, we get our telescope out, or Galileo did anyway, and looked. Well, if he hadn't found any phases, then that would have falsified the Copernican theory, and we'd be back to the Ptolemaic system. But he did find phases. So in other words, what you find is true. So in other words, the meaning is simply the practical effects that a given idea would have. And then the truth would be, okay, we go and look then, and does practical effects really happen? You know. So getting back to the Eucharist, yeah, and that's why I say there's a very fine dividing line there, but there is a distinction, right? Getting back to the Eucharist then, I mean, the meaning might be that there's this intimate relation between me and Christ, and I'm, as a Catholic, and I accept the Catholic dogma, and all of a sudden this feeling washes over me. Well, that's a practical effect, right? And guess what? It really happened. You know? Yeah, go ahead.
Something else. There are many studies made on how effective treatments in illnesses are related to how positive people are and if they believe that this is going to work or not. The people who believe that this is going to work, the percentage of people who react better to treatment is much higher than people who are skeptical and don't believe, you know.
So right.
So there is your whole being which is working together with what is being done to you.
Yeah. Well,
it's a team effort.
Well, I could add to your example, placebos. Right? I mean, people are given a placebo and they say this is X.
Right.
They believe it, and they're darn if they don't get better. Right. Sometimes, I mean, it's not 100%, but yeah, there are practical differences, is what you're saying. Yeah,
is that meaning or truth, or is it a merger?
It's the truth. I mean, the truth presupposes you've done the meaning step.
Okay.
Right. I mean, first of all, I say, what does this mean? So I say, okay, what it means is X, Y, and Z are going to happen. Whether they really do happen or not is still an open question, right? Mm-hmm. So then we do the truth step. Then we go and look and say, does it really happen? And if the answer is yes, then we, to that extent, we verify the original proposition. But if no, then that's going to be a problem for the original proposition.
Regardless of the scientific evidence behind it.
Yeah, but you see, that's the thing. If you say scientific, then you are wanting to narrow down the criteria, and that's the whole point of what James is doing with this rad pragmatic method, as I keep on saying. I mean, if the circle as is drawn, because I drew it for humankind, would pretty much cover that word scientific. But what James wants to do is take this and expand it, because this pragmatic criterion of truth is a lot more loosey-goosey. Right. You know what I mean? If you say practical effects, that's not necessarily things I can observe like and measure it like a scientist would. Yeah, Marty, I'm sorry.
So does James say that because a Catholic has this feeling that it's the actual bread of blood and body, then it therefore is true that it is?
He doesn't actually, well, I don't remember that James actually talks about transubstantiation. That was from Peirce, of course. But just judging from how he uses this so-called pragmatic criterion of truth, yes, it would encompass that.
In that sense.
See, it would encompass that. That's my big beef with James. I mean, a lot of the time he'll say something and I think, okay, I got it. You know, it's this or whatever. And next thing you know, it turns out, well, it's not quite that. It's really a lot broader than that. And I think you have to admit that there's a big difference between somebody who comes along like a logical positivist and says, okay, look, there are only two ways in which something can be true. Either it's a tautology, it's a deductive inference from axioms and definitions like we do in mathematics, either that, or it's something you have can observe and measure. Okay? That's a fairly narrow definition. You know, and if I put it that way, that's rather strict and actually has the advantage of being reasonably clear, I think. But if instead of saying that, you say, well, it's just the practical effects. What do you mean by that? You know, well, of course, it includes what we talked about, you know, measuring and observing and or deducing and like in geometry, whatever. It includes that, sure. Those are practical effects. But there are other things that are practical effects too, like, right? Right?
So that would mean that if I think I see a ghost and I'm scared and I believe I've seen one, that I really did.
Types of
situations, yeah, where somebody is affected by something, mm-hmm, which is not doesn't affect anybody else at all.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, you say, if ghosts are real, then okay, what practical effects should happen? That you would enter a dark room and a chill would come over your spine or something like that, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. That's a real tough one. But yeah, that's the problem. I mean, once you have some, it's vague. That's my whole point.
Yeah,
it's just
totally
vague. When you say practical effects, well, what does that mean?
But it could have practical effects.
Lots of things.
For example, this is what I had experienced. You know, you rush into church. I was Catholic.
Yeah.
Rushing to church, everybody's rushing to bed. After communion, you come out and everybody is like, have a great day,
right,
loving and warming and hugging your children.
Right.
And it's the whole thing, it's because you are there and you are getting this infusion of well-being,
yeah,
and kindness and thoughtfulness.
Yeah.
And you know, you have communion every Sunday.
Yeah.
So it is something like you need that.
Uh-huh.
It's like nurturing you, and you come out like better.
And in other words,
I call it practical effect.
Yes, in other words, those are practical effects. Sure, I mean all sorts of things are practical effects. That's why I say that the criterion is just pretty vague and almost promiscuously vague. And you know, if you can justify the belief in ghosts, say, well, he would never go there. I'm sure he would say, no, that's not what I mean. That's what he always says. But anyway, but let me read you then his official statement, and you'll sound here. He sounds like a logical positivist. This is what he says, and now this is the truth part. We talked about the meaning part. This is the truth part. Pragmatism, on the other hand, asks its usual question: grant an idea or belief to be true, it says, what concrete difference would its being true make in anyone's actual life? How will the truth be realized? What experiences will be different from those which would obtain if the belief were false? What, in short, is the truth? Oh, I read that, didn't I? Cast value in experiential terms. The moment pragmatism asks this question, it seeks the answer. These true ideas are those we can assimilate. I did read this, but it's worth reading again. Assimilate, validate, corroborate, and verify. False ideas are those that we cannot. That is that's the practical difference it makes to us to have true ideas. That, therefore, is the meaning of truth, for it is all that truth is known as. So here, assimilate, validate, corroborate, and verify. Sounds fairly strict, maybe. And then he goes on, in a rather Humean way, and says, truth is the name for whatever idea starts the verification process. Useful is the name for its completed function in experience. matters of fact are not only our stock and trade, relations among purely mental ideas form another sphere where true and false beliefs obtain. The objects here are mental objects. Their relations are perceptually obvious at a glance, and no sense verification is necessary. In saying what I just read, he's very much in the vein of David Hume. In fact, he even uses Hume's vocabulary, which is fairly unusual, because I said Hume's matters of fact, they're not up there anymore, are they? It was on the board at one point. Matters of fact versus relations of ideas were superseded by Kant's synthetic versus analytic language, but James actually uses Hume's language here. But anyway, yeah, he sounds very Humean and therefore Kantian, and it sounds like, at this point, it sounds like, you know, we draw the circle about the same way that Hume and Kant would have drawn it, which would then, but you'll note that if you do that, then the question of religion becomes kind of iffy, and of course both for Hume and for Kant, religion was outside the circle. Religious propositions are not amenable to scientific validation. Okay, but of course that's not the direction he goes in. He goes in a much broader direction because of the, as I say, vagueness of this idea of, you know, practical effects. That's the problem.
Well, it does legitimize a lot of ideas that other people might say are unprovable.
Yeah.
It gives legitimacy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I honestly do think part of, a large part, James was very interested in religion. I mean, no question about it. I mean, he wrote, like, well, there are three works here, like The Will to Believe and Varieties of Religious Experience, those kind of things. You know, part of his complete collection of works, a very high proportion of them are about religion, and he was interested, and he was positively oriented also to religion. So I think he really does want to loosen up this criterion some in order to be able to incorporate religion. But just the problem with this idea of how would it affect my life, practical effects kind of thing, is just so vague that you wonder if he's gone a little bit too far. And, you know.
Was he, did he consider himself a believer?
Oh, yeah. I don't think he necessarily thought of himself as an orthodox believer. And we'll get into that. I mean, as a matter of fact, I have a few minutes. Let me turn to the very end. This is the last chapter, which is titled Pragmatism and Religion. And he says this. So we see concretely two types of religion in sharp contrast. Using our old terms of comparison, we may say that the absolutistic scheme appeals to the tender-minded, while the pluralistic scheme appeals to the tough.
Yeah, get that.
Okay, I'll say a little bit more about it in a second. Many persons would refuse to call the pluralistic scheme religious at all. They would call it moralistic and would apply the word religious to the monistic structure alone. Religion in the sense of self-surrender and moralism in the sense of self-sufficingness have been pitted against each other as incompatibles frequently enough in the history of human thought. Let me explain what he's thinking here. Two types of religion. And by the way, they're oriented in, you know, using his tender-minded, tough-minded distinction. Two types of religion. There's the and they're kind of, it's on this line right here, monistic versus pluralistic. What would be a quintessential example of a monistic religion? It would be the religion of the Bhagavad Gita. I think that's the most purest, perhaps, form of that. You know, there are a lot, it's a continuum. There are lots of things in the middle, right? But something like the Bhagavad Gita is a really excellent example. I'm sure he's probably thinking of Hegel, you know, or the Hegelians, like Josiah Royce, for example. But I mean, Hegelianism is sometimes referred to as absolute idealism. absolute idealism, meaning that there's only that the world is or the fundamental nature of reality is spiritual, not material, spiritual, and there's only one of them. Whatever you want to call it. You can call it consciousness with a capital C, kind of the way Hegel does. You can call it God, or you can call it Brahman, or whatever. But in something like the Bhagavad Gita, remember Arjuna, I mentioned it before, Arjuna discovers from Krishna that fundamentally everything is just a single thing. And then at the climax of the Gita in chapter 11, Krishna gives him a divine sight, as it said, and then he just sees that everything is just this one being, and all these things are just kind of swallowed up in this one being. And so there is no free will. If you take a Maya perspective on things, that is a distorted perspective on things, and you think there are many things out there, they're all really all determined. I may think I'm freely raising my right hand, but no, there were previous states that determined that, and so forth and so on. It's all just laid out all at once, because from a Brahman type of point of view, time is external. Brahman's not in time. Everything that was, is, and will be is there all at once. So of course it's all set up, you know. So that's probably the most extreme version of this monistic kind of religion. And this is what he says about it.
Monistic with free will.
Well, without free will. That's the thing.
The contradicts the list.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. But, no, not in the case of Bhagavad Gita. That's why I say this is a... You can find exceptions to these. Are just general tendencies. But listen to what he says, and I'll have to close with this probably. This is the monistic religion. He says, what do believers in the absolute mean? Once again, kind of a pragmatic. What's the cash value of this absolute talk? What does it mean? By saying that their belief affords them comfort. Okay, fine. They mean, and that's the pragmatic, that's the practical effect. You know, this belief in the absolute somehow gives me comfort. You know. Oh, I can digress for just a second. I got a couple of minutes. Yes. Oh, you say this. Well, we don't. You're right. Oh, darn it. All right. Well, shoot. I'll read this, and then I'll talk more or less next time. They mean that since in the absolute, finite evil is overruled already, we may therefore, whenever we wish, treat the temporal as if it were potentially the eternal, be sure that we can trust its outcome, and without sin, dismiss our fear and drop worry of our finite responsibility. In short, they mean that we have a right ever and anon to take a moral holiday, to let the world wag on in its own way, feeling that its issues are in better hands than ours and are none of our business. All right, we'll talk more about that next time.
Hello.
I forgot to call my mother. See, she was coming to church.
Oh,
are your parents coming?
I think they're taking the shuttle.
Dawn is
there? Ooh, I'm sorry. Oh, shoot. just as Bonnie was asking me a question, I hit stop. I think she was going to say, is there any class next week?
And the answer would be?
Well, I think we're just having one service, aren't we?
Oh, I don't know.
And if we are, then yes, it will be in 2 weeks. I should have said that, and I didn't even think about it. But I'll send her an email.
Well, she's not here anyway, so if she logs in, she hasn't lost a heck of a lot.
Yeah, that's true. But I'll send her.
S-T-E-I-N.
Yeah, right.
Other states.
Right now.
Anyway, so for some vague reason, I remember that his estate was in Doylestown.
That's right.
So I wonder whatever happened to it.
I think it may be a tourist attraction.
Oh, like it survived?
And James Michener's.
He was from there too?
Well, I think he ended up there. I don't know if he was from there.
Oh, the same property or from the same area?
Not the same. Well, it's in town, actually. Yes.
And,
see ya.
Yeah, I can understand, say, a guy like him, you know.